Good morning.
Good morning.
Good to see you. Is this thing on? Okay. How lovely to be here. You know, we're about to start Rohatsu session. How wonderful is that? So there'll be people here practicing intensively for the next week in growing numbers. I think tomorrow there'll be about 15 of us here, and by Saturday there'll be 45 or so. It's going to be cozy. And anyway, so just so you know, all our regular programming for next week is going to be not happening except Sunday morning, Dharma Talk. Come next week. It's going to be good. And Tuesday night. I'm looking forward to spending some time practicing with my friends. So today, I want to talk about the Bahya Sutra. Bahya Sutta is from the earliest layer of Buddhist text called the Pali Canon. And I thought of doing this because I'm teaching a class on Pali Canon texts in January. So then I started reading them and I was like, man, this stuff is cool. That's what happens. Like, wow. So then I thought, oh, I want to talk about this. And I just want to say, at the same time as I'm teaching that Pali Canon class, Busho will be teaching a class on the Four Noble Truths. So the idea is the one I'm teaching is the Advanced Studies class, and the one he's teaching is a Foundation to Practice class. So one is more designed for people who have longer-term practice and experience relating to the texts, and one for people with a little less experience. You can talk to us if you want to sort out what's good for you. So anyway, the Pali Canon is like the earliest record of Buddhism. It's still considered the canonical text for Theravadan Buddhism, which is a different school than our Soto Zen. And the Pali Canon fit in a bookshelf about like this, maybe like that. So it's like the biggest Bible you could ever find. One of the characteristics that you'll see, I'm going to read you this whole sutra, the Bahya Sutra, which takes about 5 minutes, is something very common in Pali Canon texts, is that you have elements which would probably most of us would consider supernatural or outside of verifiable empirical truth, if you like want to put the truth word on it. And so there's stuff that seems like religious or supernatural happening. And then right next to it, with absolutely no segue or differentiation, are very simple, clear, psychological, practical instructions. And this is very consistent in this body of literature. So if somehow you've read some books and people are like, yes, Buddhism is just totally rational, I think you're being misled, to be honest. So I like to just touch this textual tradition as it is, and touch the fact that it's like, oh, there's this practical thing, and then there's this supernatural thing, and how are they functioning? And one thing I would like to point out is there's a possibility or something that happens where people say, well, Buddhism is very rational, and then there's this weird supernatural stuff that sort of somehow got culturally agglommed onto it. But really, Buddhism was just a rational system that the Buddha made up. This may be true, but it doesn't seem possible to confirm it. And the problem with it as a line of discourse is it tends to be a bunch of white people saying that a bunch of Asian people don't know what their tradition really was. And that's not cool. So I like to try and touch the whole thing and find a way to have a respect for the whole of the tradition. Doesn't mean I have to believe everything in it is true or perfect. I certainly don't. Not even close. So anyway, you'll see these elements in this text as we read it. The sutra is called the Bahya Sutra because it's about a fellow named Bahya. And he's known as Bahya of the bark cloth because he wore clothing made of bark, as one does. So actually, it seems, you know, there was a cultural tendency in India at the time, and I think still, for people to sort of shed all material possessions, almost all of them, and then devote themselves to spiritual practice and then be supported by their communities just, you know, with some food and basic medical requisites. And so people, Buddhists and non-Buddhists, were doing this in many numbers, and they're all different kinds. If you read the Pali Canon, you'll encounter all these different types. And one of the kinds was people who wore cloth made of bark, which sounds super comfy. I would like maybe a down lining at this time of year would be good. So what else can I say? In this sutra, you will encounter a devata, which is like a minor deity. So a being from the god realms, who god realm beings come in. They tend to talk to people who have a lot of spiritual power, but sometimes they just show up when they feel like it. So there's a devata. And if I encounter things that are likely to be completely baffling, I might just throw in a little aside as I'm reading through this. So anyway, let's hear about Bahya. Thus I have heard. On one occasion, the Blessed One, that's the Buddha, was staying near Savadi in Jetta's Grove at Anathapindika's monastery. And on that occasion, Bahya of the bark cloth was living in Suparaka by the seashore. Bahya was worshipped, revered, honored, venerated, and given homage, a recipient of robes, alms food, lodging, and medicinal requisites for the sick. Then, when he was alone in seclusion, this line of thinking appeared in his awareness. Now, of those who in this world are arhats, which in short means enlightened people, be a way to think of it. Of those who in this world are arhats or have entered the path of arhatship, am I one? I wonder if I'm enlightened. I'm sure you always ask yourself that question. Then a devata, who had once been a blood relative of Bahya of the bark cloth, compassionate, desiring Bahya's welfare, knowing with her own awareness the line of thinking that had arisen in his awareness, went to him and on arrival said to him, "You, Bahya, are neither an arhat nor have you entered the path of arhatship. You don't even have the practice whereby you would become an arhat or enter the path of arhatship." Bummer. Yeah. Then who in the world with its devas and arhats or have entered the path to arhatship? Then who in this world with its devas are arhats or have entered the path to arhatship? Bahya, said the devata, there is a city in the northern county named Savati. There, the Blessed One, an arhat, rightly self-awakened, talking about the Buddha now, is living now. He truly is an arhat and teaches the Dharma of leading to arhatship. Then, Bahya, deeply chastised by the devata, left Suparaka right then, and in the space of one night went all the way to where the Blessed One was staying near Savati. By the way, that's 1,200 miles. Jetta's Grove, Anathapindika's monastery. Now on that occasion, a large number of monks were doing walking meditation in the open air. He went to them, and on arrival said, "Where, venerable sirs, is the Blessed One, the arhat, rightly self-awakening, now staying? We want to see that Blessed One, the arhat, rightly self-awakened. They said, "The Blessed One has gone into town for alms." So Buddha's begging for food. That's what every morning, begs for food. Goes home, meditates, and helps people. That's his day. Schedule. Then Bahya, hurriedly leaving Jetta's Grove and entering Savati, the town, saw the Blessed One going for alms in Savati. Serene and inspiring. Inspiring serene confidence. Calming his senses at peace. His mind at peace. Having attained the utmost tranquility and poise. Tamed, guarded. His senses restrained. A great one. A naga. Seeing him, he approached the Blessed One, and on reaching him, threw himself down with his head at the Blessed One's feet, and said, "Teach me the Dharma, O Blessed One, teach me the Dharma. O one well gone, this will be for my long-term welfare and bliss." When this was said, the Blessed One said to him, "This is not the time, Bahya. We have entered the town for alms." A second time, Bahya said to the Blessed One, "But it is hard to know for sure what dangers there may be for the Blessed One's life, or what dangers there may be for mine. Teach me the Dharma, O Blessed One, teach me the Dharma, O well-gone one, that will be for my long-term welfare and bliss." A second time, the Blessed One said to him, "This is not the time, Bahia. We have entered the town for alms." A third time, Bahia said to the Blessed One, "But it is hard to know for sure what dangers there may be for the Blessed One's life, or what dangers there may be for mine. Teach me the Dharma, O Blessed One. Teach me the Dharma, O One well gone, that will be for my long-term welfare and bliss." Here, Bahia, you should train yourself thus. In the seen, there will be merely that which is seen. In the heard, will be merely what is heard. In the sensed, will be merely what is sensed. In the cognized, will be merely what is cognized. In this way, you should train yourself, Bahia. When, Bahia, for you, in the seen, is merely what is seen. In the heard, merely what is heard. In the sensed, merely what is sensed. In the cognized is merely what is cognized. Then, Bahia, you will not be with that. When, Bahia, you are not with that, then, Bahia, you will not be in that. When, Bahia, you are not in that, then, Bahia, you will be neither here nor yonder nor in between the two. Just this is the end of suffering. Through hearing this brief explanation of the Dharma from the Blessed One, the mind of Bahia of the bark cloth right then and there was released from taints through lack of clinging. Having exhorted Bahia of the bark cloth with this brief explanation of the Dharma, the Blessed One left. Now, not long after the Blessed One's departure, Bahia was attacked and killed by a cow with a young calf. Then the Blessed One, having gone for alms and savati after the meal, returning home from his alms round with a large number of monks, saw that Bahia had died. On seeing him, he said to the monks, "Take Bahia's body, monks, and placing it on a litter and carrying it away, cremate it and build him a memorial. Your companion in the holy life has died." Responding, "As you say, Lord," to the Blessed One, the monks, placing Bahia's body on a litter, carrying it away, cremating it, and building him a memorial, went to the Blessed One. On arrival, having bowed down to him, sat to one side. As they were sitting there, they said to him, "Bahia's body has been cremated, Lord, and his memorial has been built. What is his destination? What is his future state?" Question, how will he be reborn? "Monks, Bahia of the bark cloth was wise. He practiced the Dharma in accordance with the Dharma and did not pester me with issues related to the Dharma. Bahia of the bark cloth, monks, is totally unbound. So he's entered Nirvana and will not be reborn." Then, on realizing the significance of that, the Blessed One on that occasion exclaimed, "Where neither water, nor yet earth, nor fire, nor air gain a foothold, there gleam no stars, no sun sheds light. There shines no moon, yet there no darkness reigns. When a sage, a Brahmin, has come to know this for himself through his own wisdom, then he is freed from form and formlessness, freed from pleasure and freed from pain." All right. So, as I talk about this, I'm not going to pick out one little element and really stay there. So I'm going to have a kind of a talk that works through many, many parts of this. The first thing I want to mention is the urgency of Bahia's spiritual impulse or impulse to do something for the alleviation of suffering. So he's like, he's already like a kind of like a famous, you know, ascetic guy. People are like, "Oh, we go to this guy, we give him stuff. We have a great sage living in the woods near our town. It feels great." And he's like, he's still curious, you know, like Subhuti. If you were at any of my other talks, like Sudhana in the Gandavyuha, the impulse to continue to practice and to learn is strong. And it's powerful, so that when he's immediately just like, "Whoa, I could do something." He jumps up and goes to do it, and he like travels through who knows what means. They didn't have trains. 1,200 miles from the coast to Savatthi. And then, you know, immediately it's like, where's the Buddha? And we're like, Buddha's going to get breakfast. And he's like, you know, runs down to the day-by-day cafe. Buddha's like, I'm just ordering. No, but, you know, he's... People know that, you know, you don't teach during alms round. That's a known thing in this culture. And he can't wait. And, you know, you might think, well, that's, you know, impatience, that's not good. But we see in this, you know, later on, Buddha says, he didn't pester me with the Dharma. It sounded kind of like pestering. You know, I'm sorry, I'm busy. I'm going to town for alms. It's not the time. And no, teach me now. We don't know if we will live till the end of the day. The urgency. Where is your urgency? How much of your urgency is exhausted on, like, you know, how am I going to get to work on time? Am I going to be able to get my laundry done? Our laundry is important, but the urgency of our heart gets misdirected profoundly when we have the opportunity of human life. As Dogen says in the Fukan Zazengi, you have gained the pivotal opportunity of human form. Do not pass your days and nights in vain. You are taking care of the essential activity of the Buddha way. Who would take wasteful delight in the spark from a flintstone? I once heard Michael O'Neill, who teaches at Compassionate Ocean, he just said, our culture is designed to make people feel like their life doesn't matter. You know, it's like, or it doesn't matter in any really important way. You know, you just kind of consume some stuff, you get by, it's all cool. We have an opportunity here. So I encourage you to keep finding ways to find some urgency around your practice that can just motivate you to jump into it. So then we get this teaching. Buddha doesn't even like preface it either. He's like, no, I'm busy. No, this isn't a good time. And then he's just like, bahia. And you just imagine the immediacy of that connection. There's just two people. It's just two people standing out, like, on a road in a small town. The roads are made of dirt. You know, there's probably animals moving around. And one of them's like, help me. And he says, no, I'm busy. Help me. No, I'm busy. Help me. You know what? Wow. So what does he say? Here, Bahia, you should train yourself thus. In the seen will be merely what is seen. In the heard will be merely what is heard. In the sensed will be merely what is sensed. In the cognized will be merely what is cognized. In this way you should train yourself, Bahia. When, Bahia, for you, in the seen is merely what is seen. In the heard, merely what is heard. In the sensed, merely what is sensed. In the cognized is merely what is cognized, then, Bahia, you will not be with that. When, Bahia, you are not with that, then you will not be in that. When, Bahia, you are not in that, then, Bahia, you will be neither here nor yonder nor in between the two. Just this is the end of suffering. So, I'd like to say that this is a nice immediate teaching that works really well for Bahia. How cool is that? Well, I'll probably, you know, I hate this sutra because I'm like, I'm pretty sure I'm never going to deliver that three-sentence teaching that somehow liberates someone's mind. Well, you know, you kind of, we read these texts, you think, oh, I just got to find that teacher who can just say the thing and then I'm free. Remember, Bahia spent his whole life practicing already. So there's a catalyzing that happens here, and it's a particular catalyzing because this is actually a pretty distinct teaching. You spend a lot of time sort of looking at how it relates to other ways of teaching mental training in Pali Canon texts, but it's got a very distinct flavor that's different than some of them. So he's like kind of looks at the guy and goes, "Okay, I got something for you," and it clicks. How wonderful is that? But my point being here that this isn't like the only way or the ultimate practice. You know, it can start to look like, oh, we found the really good one. So this one is good for someone who's really already immersed in practice, who's divested themselves of their neediness for material comfort, and who has really settled down and found out to be deeply calm. And what is the teaching? In the scene, it will just be the scene. So what's it usually like when there's a scene? Are you aware that in the scene, like most of you seem to be looking at me, there's also like a you looking at me? Are you aware that that is probably true? Check it out. Does it feel like there's a you looking at me? Probably. If not, you can join Bahia. In the herd, just the herd. So, well, I like this. We have a couple kinds of meditation that are emphasized here. One is one where we pick an object of focus and sustain attention on it. So, like if you come here for Intro to Zazen, and most of the time people are practicing meditation here, most of us are practicing kind of bringing awareness into the breath. The breath is like a grounding for our awareness, and we can become intimate with our bodies, which is so good and important and valuable. So there's a picked, you choose something to focus on. And then conversely, or in relationship to it, we have objectless meditation. Objectless being there's no purpose, so you're not trying to attain something or accomplish something. There's no object. And two, there's no particular object that you're focusing on. Just, I don't know how to put it. It's already happening. Objectless is already how it is. So we step into how it isness. Objectlessness is a little hard to talk about because it so seems like things are objects. So anyway, you know, practically speaking, generally speaking, we have the idea that maybe you sustain attention on the breath till your mind becomes a little bit calm, and then you can relax your attempt to do something. Well, the attempt to do something tends to bind up with wanting to accomplish something, and then it has to have an object, and then suddenly you're building up some problems. So it's like, shut up, mind, problems, or I don't want this feeling, can I hide it? Or, I wonder if my neighbor in the Zendo could just stop breathing. If they did that, then everything would be cool. So anyway, what's great about this instruction by the Buddha is it's subjectless meditation. He's just like, in the seen, there's what's seen. In the heard, there's what's heard. In the sense, there's what's sensed, and in what cognized is what's cognized. And if that's true, there'll be no you with that. There's not a subject to a view, an object, and there will be no you in that. You haven't projected yourself into it so that you have to manipulate it. And you won't be here, in between, here, there, or in between. And there's just like, for all of you in TV land listening to this, I'm just pointing at the world. So the thing is, you can't really make the sensed be just the sensed. This is something that requires, Bahia has a lot of preparation. So it's going to be pretty hard for you to just leap right now into this way. That's why we have retreats. They provide an opportunity to slow down enough so that you can have the experience of the scene just being the scene. It's very hard to touch this without a sustained amount of time to practice. It doesn't mean that you can't not do retreats and have a wonderful practice. So not everyone has to do retreats. However, the kind of practice being recommended by the Buddha in this sutra is going to be pretty tough if you don't find ways to slow way down. Because the habit of mind to constantly be projecting itself into the scene, analyzing the scene, is so profound. So, for those of you who are going to be hanging out at Rohatsu, feel free to just have the scene be the scene. The Eno will take care of, like, whoever's at the door. Thank you, Anne. A little puzzling thing in here is there are clear formulas that are repeated throughout Pali Canon texts about how to analyze experience psychologically, the two main ones being the five senses in the mind, which is the six senses, or the five aggregates. So here he comes up with a new formula, the seen, the heard, the sensed, and the cognized. And I don't know Pali, so I can't dig around and really get his, like, so he just kind of, or is there some particular reason for this? But what I got to say is cognized has got to include mental things. So within thoughts, they're just thoughts. Within feelings, normally in Buddhist psychology, everything that is not within the five senses is considered mental. So your emotional states and thoughts, like those little word things that happen in your mind that we learn about when we practice meditation. What are those? So normally we're so identified with them, we don't even see that there's a separation. And then there can start to be like, maybe you start to have, you can actually like, wow, that's a thought over there. That's actually really hard to do because your consciousness is so conditioned to bind to the thoughts. So like if you're practicing meditation and you start thinking, usually you just suddenly find yourself in a daydream, right? It's hard to be like, yeah, the thoughts are just over here happening like the visual field. That's very hard to do. It's a little bit easier with your feelings. That's a good place to start. Let within the feelings, the cognized be just the cognized. So you don't have to mess with them. Oh, it's like, oh, I have a feeling. I better figure this out. What did my dad do to cause me to have this feeling? It's a valid and useful line of inquiry, but it's not what is recommended in this particular tradition. So you can do that. That's a good practice, but it's a different practice. So when you're in the Zendo, you don't have to do it. You can just be like, wow, that's just the feeling feels like that. And the amazing thing is sometimes like the feeling is really good. And you just be like, the feeling feels like that. And the amazing thing is you can, if you really can just let it be, you can be free from it. So you don't get up and go during the next Zazen period when you feel bad. You're not like, where's my good feeling? This is what he's talking about at the end when he says freed from pleasure. It doesn't mean you don't experience pleasure. It's you're free. We get bound by things that feel good. I'm like, well, can I get it back? How do I get it back? And then we get bound by things that are painful. And we can also just be like, wow, it's just, that's just something that's happening. And let it be itself. There's healing there. So the danger of this teaching is the emphasis on effacing the self. So this is why you don't want to give this teaching to everyone or overly emphasize it. So the Buddha meets Bahya. He kind of sees an intuitive teacher. This will work for this guy. Apparently it worked. But the thing is, for some of us, there's a tendency to like want to be like, what I would like to do, I read in Buddhism, you can just like not have a self. And some part of us finds that profoundly appealing. And that part is not maybe that spiritual urgency, but just a pain around having to carry ourself with us. And so we can begin to use spiritual practice to escape ourselves. And this is not going to be helpful. So the thing is, that's why it's important to recognize that the cognized includes feelings and thoughts. Everything that you could consider yourself still keeps happening. None of it is pushed away or destroyed, but somehow it can all just be arising without hardening and identifying around it. But a simple way to just check in on this is you can just ask yourself, am I using my practice to get away from myself? If that is what I'm doing, I need some help. And then go find someone who can help you. That's what we have, teachers, and we have friends on the path and a community to do that. Okay. So, Bahia is released. How about that? Through hearing this brief explanation of the Dharma from the Blessed One, the mind of Bahia, the bark cloth, right then and there was released from taints through lack of clinging. Pretty cool. He's just like, he saw something. Probably the sensed in what was sensed and the seen in what was seen. But I just like to say that he was released from the taints. The taints means the patterns of mind that cause suffering through lack of clinging. And I just can't help bringing up in the Four Noble Truths, the third noble truth is the truth of cessation, the end of suffering. And this is how it is defined in my favorite translation. What is cessation of suffering? It is the remainderless fading and cessation, the complete renunciation, relinquishment, release, and letting go of that craving. Renunciation, relinquishment, release, and letting go. That means we're holding on to the craving that binds us to suffering. We're holding on to it, and we can let go. We can let go. It feels like there's like this sort of pernicious universe that binds us to suffering, or maybe there's these pernicious personal tendencies that bind us to suffering. But finally, there's just a tendency of mind to hold on to our suffering, and our practice is to recognize that it's possible to just let it go. And Bahia experiences this. So then, Bahia is killed by the cow. So we have traffic around here. It's automobiles, but apparently cows are dangerous too. Is certainly this highlights the urgency of the story. And also, then Buddha's like, he taught this guy, he met him for like 2 minutes, right, in this story. And then when the guy dies, he says to the other monks, he was your companion on the path. He was devoted to practice. That's very sweet. It's just very sweet, I think. Everyone's included. Everyone's included who wants to participate. So, anyway, then, at the end, we get something that's pretty common in Pali Canon texts. Not like all the time, but it happens in many, many ones. Someone dies, and then the monks go to the Buddha and go, what's going to happen? What's going to happen to Bob? What's going to happen to Bahia? And the Buddha answers. He's like, I can see how people will be reborn. That's one of my capacities that I developed through realization, and I will tell you. So, I don't know if that's true. But that's what the stories say. And in this case, he says Bahia is unbound. Sometimes they'll say, this person, their practice was good. They're gonna be reborn 2 more times. It'll be a twice returner, sometimes once returner. So this is part of the discourse. And, from the Mahayana perspective, which is we're a Mahayana school here, the idea isn't to be done being reborn. The idea is to commit to liberating people no matter what. So it's different. In the Pali Canon, this is like Bahia is like the ultimate. He's going to Nirvana. He's done. He's not coming back. And the Mahayana is like, what would be great is if Bahia was like, I'm so close to Nirvana, but I'm just going to stay. I'm going to find some suffering to touch so that I have some opportunity to do enact liberation. So that's a different flavor that we emphasize here. But I'm going to shift gears here, and I want to talk about rebirth. Out of this article that I read in the New York Times called What If We're All Coming Back? What if we're all coming back? I can't help saying, I don't know if you guys are familiar with the rap musician Drake. Drake has a song and a mantra and a motto, which is YOLO, you only live once. So MIA, who's a rapper with Indian heritage, has a song called YALA, you always live again. Which, I gotta say, is a jam. Anyway, so this op-ed piece in the New York Times called What If We're All Coming Back was written by Michelle Alexander. So Michelle Alexander is basically a hero of mine. She's an attorney who worked for many years helping. Well, a big project of hers was to address, raise awareness around, and correct the mass incarceration of people in the United States, particularly people of color. And she wrote a great book called The New Jim Crow. So anyway, she had done that work. And by the way, that work she's done is bearing a lot of fruit. As I mentioned last time, there's actually quite a bit of progress and a lot more work to do to enact reform in this regard. I can't help saying this either. So recently, U.S. News and World Report said Minnesota is the second best state in the United States to live in. Pretty cool. And then if you go down and drill into the details, one of the things that you can find is that rates of disparity in incarceration between white and non-white people were 49th. That is, there's only one state that's worse than Minnesota. So, just to consider what's going on. So anyway, Michelle Alexander recently, a few years ago, was like, I'm going to change my focus and start teaching at Union Theological Seminary, which is a seminary that has various interreligious programs. It has a Buddhist program, Christian programs, been Christian for a long time, and a lot of social justice work. So anyway, she wrote this great op-ed called What If We're All Coming Back? And this, the first thing that blew my mind, she says, you know, rebirth is an idea that's been around for a long time, and 32% of the people in the United States believe in it. Are you guys stunned by that? Not only that, 29% of Christians in the United States believe in reincarnation. This is Pew Research, a really good, you know, the gold standard of research on religious opinion in the United States. Wow! Fascinating. I'll bet that's higher than in this Buddhist place. I'm not sure. I'm not going to take a poll because I don't want to embarrass people, but it's like, that's just fascinating. I love it that people can be so surprising. Then talks about is rebirth as an idea that has utility for helping people to understand why it matters to care about people and to create social systems that support everyone. And basically she says, like, if someone recognizes that they are going to be reborn into this world, for example, then what are they looking at the likelihood of happening? So she just gives some information. Almost half the world, more than 3 billion people, live on less than $2.50 per day. At least 80% of humanity lives on less than $10 per day. The vast majority of the Earth's population is non-white, and roughly half are women. Unless radical change sweeps the globe, the chances are high that any of us, if we were reborn, would come back as a non-white woman living on less than $2.50 per day. Given what we now know about climate change, the chances are very good that we would find ourselves suffering as a result of natural disaster and enduring water and food shortages and refugee crises. It's nearly impossible to imagine, she says, that our elected officials would be so indifferent if they knew climate scientists were foretelling a future that they would have to live in without any of the privileges they now enjoy. And this is a very common argument for rebirth that the Buddha himself makes and is commonly made by people who are really into advocating for the thought, is that it's a way of, like, helping us understand why it's important to be ethical. So she goes on. I'm just going to read because she writes really well. Morality only becomes possible when we step outside of the box of our perceived self-interest and care for others as much as we care for ourselves. Perhaps we ought to imagine that we personally will be born again into the world that we are creating today through our collective and individual choices. Who among us would fail to question capitalism or to demand a political system free from corporate cash if we knew that we'd likely live our next life as a person of color earning less than $2.50 a day in some part of the world ravaged by climate change while private corporations earn billions building prisons, detention centers, and border walls for profit? Not I, she says, and I'm willing to bet neither would you. We don't have to believe in reincarnation to fight for a world that we'd actually want to be born into. So this is a little trick. You don't even believe it, but just by thinking about it for a minute, you go, wait a minute. That's crazy. So one of the things I've been thinking about rebirth, though, is if you don't remember anything about your past lives, why does it matter that that person you will be reborn is as you, is you? Why does that matter any more than that someone else would be? It's a total trick. Does that make sense to you? If you have, no one has any memory of their past lives, why would it matter that in a future life what you're creating for yourself is somehow special? It's using the trick of our egocentricity to try and motivate us. But Mahayana Buddhism actually actively dismantles that in the attempt to make us recognize that all future births are our own. All past births are our own, and all present births, all people, are within the bounds of our profoundly interconnected condition. So any of these ways can work. So, then, coming back to the Buddha's instruction, in the sensed, just what is sensed. In the heard, just what's heard. So some of our practice should be to just let everything be what it is. By doing that, it actually, that's how, according to this tradition, the Buddha actually learned to be able to understand this depth of connection. So one of the ways that we learn to deeply understand this interconnection is by not thinking about it and just sitting down quietly, taking care of simple tasks, bowing at the door, bowing at the cushion, lifting up a pair of chopsticks, taking one step. But that's not the whole of the picture, because then we have to take another step. Thank you. Well, we have some time for questions and comments.
Supernatural?
Miraculous powers! Miraculous powers. Well, shall we just move on? Everyone's so excited for Rohatsu, you just can't. I know how it is. Yes?
As you started talking, I was wondering if you could
explain just a little bit of the translation of the Pali Canon and how it came to be that we have it in our English version today, and what could maybe be some pitfalls from, you know, some of the things that are explained in there, and what kind of filters that I had to go through to where it is today.
Yeah, good. So, well, the first filter is that Pali isn't even a language, but they, so, like, the fact that it's called the Pali Canon is people thought, like, 2,000 years ago the language was called Pali, but actually Pali is a word that meant text in the original language. So, that was I'm going to make a better answer. So, there was some language that was spoken by the followers of the Buddha, and then 500 years later, people started writing it down in this language, which is now called Pali, which was a Prakrit language. So we have 500 years of oral transmission before it was even translated, through probably translation through multiple languages, before the first written record. So already, who even knows what's said? We don't know. And then the thing is, that Pali record that was transcribed at that time, my understanding, has been very meticulously kept. So, like, that, we have, like, exact that. And then, the amazing thing, I was talking about someone the other day, is there are various translations of Pali Canon texts into the English language. Various people have been doing them, but they're different. It's good to study different ones. But I am, like, a big fan of this guy, Bhikkhu Bodhi, and he is truly incredible. He has done what most people consider to be absolute excellent translations of all five main Nikaya, which is, like, in tiny, thin paper, encyclopedia-like books. And actually, in the last one in the intro, he's like, I'm so toast from this. The other cool thing about him, and he's a great commentator, the other cool thing about him is now he's like out in the streets advocating for transforming our culture to support people who are marginalized and harmed by systems. Which is also cool to me. You could probably guess. So.
So is there a Reader's Digest version?
There are some. So there are a couple books that are pretty good that are sort of like, these are some really central texts. We'll be using, in the class I'm teaching, we'll be using In the Buddha's Words, which is a selection by Bhikkhu Bodhi. There's also a really good one by someone named Wallace. Do you know someone here? One of the priests here gave it to me. Yeah, that sounds right. So there's a couple other good shorter books. My opinion is the more recent, the better. Scholarship around Buddhism has really, really improved as people have deepened their knowledge and practice in the West. So, like, when you look at stuff from 50 years ago, there's some that's really cool, but you really see, in my opinion, how much practice and knowledge have been accumulated in our culture around it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There's that book by Bhikkhu Bodhi called The Eightfold Noble Path.
Ooh.
It's a condensation of
that sounds. I don't know that one, but it sounds great. I would recommend it, right offhand, frankly.
It's short, and he actually gives it away on his website.
Whoa! How cool is that? I will say this about, you know, exploring the Buddhist textual tradition. I recommend doing it in the context with a teacher and some kind of teaching format. It's pretty hard to just access on your own, and it can really come to life in a group with good support. That's been my experience. Oh.
Hey, Ben.
Yeah.
So, you know, you pointed out how this teaching was practical, one sentence, and then, you know, what you referred to as supernatural in the very next. But don't you think that all of our teachings try to come to us from both those contexts, from the context of our practical everyday life, which Jeffrey just demonstrated, but also they strive to come to us from the level of interconnectedness.
Mm-hmm.
And if everything is thoroughly interconnected, thoroughly interpenetrated, how can there not be a supernatural beyond our everyday experience aspect to reality? And don't you think that all of our koans, all of our teachings strive to come to us from both of those?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a cool question. I'll say I was trying to say not so much that the thing is supernatural, but that it would be normally categorized as supernatural by many of the people in this room. Does that make sense? So it's like, because what exactly does supernatural mean? But I think kind of the point that our tradition is encouraging us to look beyond our kind of like narrow framework of understanding into something that's beyond what we could know conventionally and what we do know. I think so. Yeah. And they use kind of a variety of tools. Is that, I think I'm, yes. My answer is yes. All right. Well, this has been lovely to get to be here with you this morning. And we'll see some of you this evening and some of you maybe next Sunday. And wherever you are. In the sensed, what is sensed? In what is felt? Thank you.